Blog Talk Radio.
Course, it's interesting on BBC, the host, the news hostess, was wearing orange. I thought it was interesting considering it's St. Patrick's week when the Irish. They started early Tuesday. Was it Tuesday night? They were a bar was open with a bunch of Irish and were drinking here in San Francisco. And of course, I understand some are still drinking. Anyway, we're going to play a repeat since the Irish are most interesting. You can love them and you can hate them and you can be appalled at some of the things that they've done, but they've had quite an impact on North American civilization, our history, inventions like John Holland, the inventor of the modern submarine. A lot of people didn't know that Sylvester Graham, invented the self-rising flour, and of course graham crackers are named after him. And of course, we have in the music world Patrick Gilmore, who was contemporary. He was a bandmaster, contemporary of John Philip Sousa, and he was known as the Great Gilmore. And of course, we've had the politicians. Boss Tweed actually was half Irish. His mother was a McGreer. And of course, we generally know of him for corruption, but I've learned some other things about him. Fascinating man. We will have a special show on William Tweed. But anyway, I'm going to play a repeat of Patrick Butler, which since we discussed the Irish, we're going to play a repeat of an interview I did where we talked about Irish exceptionalism.
Okay, I think that's okay. Why do the Irish think they're special?
Because we are.
We are
the people that, to a degree, preserved literacy in Europe and elsewhere throughout the Dark Ages. We are the people who, at various times, were called on to save Christianity in Europe and elsewhere. We are the people who, if you could ask Abraham Lincoln, probably did the most of any group to save the Union during the Civil War. You might also get similar comments from Confederate sympathizers who feel that some of their best people were Irishmen who had just gotten off the boat. So we came here speaking the language, being literate, and understanding how a democracy works. That put us at a big advantage over other groups.
But some people the Irish, when they're not yanking the lion's tail, and of course there are others who'd like to yank that tail, as a bunch of boasters, braggarts, brawlers, and a few, or too many, buggerers. How do you explain that away?
I don't know about buggery being the Irish disease. I thought that was more of an English matter. As a matter of fact, there was a priest at the school that you and I both went to who, on more than one occasion, referred to the queer peers of Oxford.
Well, there's something to be said, but some of them had Irish names.
Well, yeah, but...
Oscar Wilde?
Oscar was Wilde, it's true. But Oscar was one of these ascendancy Irish. He was... he had a little tinge of orange.
Now, what is the difference between the people in the South, the Republic, and then the Orangemen, or Ulstermen up north? Is there a difference in behavior?
Yes, there is. Yes,
what
there
is that?
Not only in behavior, but see, all right, the Ulstermen in the north, and the reason they're called Orangemen is many of them came over here with William of Orange.
You mean to Ireland?
Pardon?
To
Ireland, yeah.
Right.
They were the people who were planted in Ireland to take over the lands that previously belonged to the Irish Catholic lords. And when Cromwell came, and later when James, they were, we've got a little bit of a noise in the background.
Oh, don't worry about that. That's,
okay.
Don't worry, they're not coming for you yet.
Okay. And anyway, they were brought to take over the lands that had been confiscated from the Irish Catholics. They were called Orangemen because they were supporters of William of Orange.
The Dutchman.
Who was a Dutchman.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was from the House of Orange.
In the South.
That's where that came from. Each year, on some of their historic anniversaries, the Orangemen don orange sashes and with their bigger drums than the rest of the Irish use, march their way through Belfast and other cities in Northern Ireland to kind of rub it in. And but they've been there for 300 years or more. They do consider themselves to be Irish. And I'm going to say something that might get me killed in some bars on the south side of Chicago. Some of the earliest fighters for Irish independence from England were Orangemen. The leaders of the Revolution of 1798, the leaders of the Young Ireland movement in the 1840s were, to a large extent, disenchanted Irish Protestants. They were the ones who, in the early 1900s, formed the Citizens Brigades in favor of, if they weren't going to get home rule, which some of them wanted, some of them didn't, they wanted full independence and as a separate country, or at least as a self-governing province within the Commonwealth of Nations.
Oh, you mean of England?
Right, that's what they called their...
Oh, okay, well,
okay.
Commonwealth is more associated with it. Well, what is it about the Irish that... you mentioned Catholic. Now, I understand that on Sunday and in the Holy Days of Obligation, the women and the children go to services, but the men go to the bars.
Well, men may sleep in.
I don't know about with whom.
You
or
know, the business about the bars, I mean, there's this stereotype of, you know, the Irish being the world's heaviest drinkers and all of that. That's nonsense. The Poles and the Russians put us to shame.
Not that much. I mean, I understand you guys can really put away the whiskey. You can't handle the beer.
Well, some can, but then again, you know, I mean, that's an ethnic stereotype. And as a matter of fact, that's a bit like handing an Afro-American person a watermelon and telling him to dig in. Not all blacks like watermelon. Not all Irish get drunk.
Now, since you mentioned African Americans, in which I don't use the term, I call them blacks, because not all blacks came from Africa.
Right.
What is it about Irish racism? I have, you know, even though we went to the same school, which was predominantly Irish most of the time,
right.
Except
right.
on St. Patrick's Day, where some of us wore orange.
I don't think I saw you wearing orange. I don't think, you know, you're one for twisting people's tails. I know this. But I don't think even you had the cojones to wear orange on St. Patrick's Day.
Well,
you were many things, but you were never suicidal.
Well, but the racists, I've heard many Irish, especially in places like Chicago, and even Irish ethnic cops, talk about the blacks, the Schwartzes. Well, of course, that's Yiddish.
Right.
But yet we see, I don't know the demographic statistics of the number of Irish ethnics that have married or have slept with blacks. But I don't understand this. Why is there this racism among the Irish against the blacks?
Well, I think part of it stems from the period before and during the Civil War, when freed blacks and slaves were taking jobs that would normally have gone to the Irish.
Okay.
Why? Because if you owned a slave, why you didn't need to hire an Irishman. On the other hand, during the war, all of these freed blacks, the Civil War, all of these freed blacks were coming north and taking jobs which were being held by the Irish. It wasn't only the Irish that had that resentment. The Germans did also, except that by that time, the Germans were into slightly higher status jobs because they had been here and established themselves as craftsmen and that kind of thing. But there was a certain amount, there's always a certain amount of resentment when new arrivals come and take the jobs that belong to the group that came just before them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can see
that.
Slavers
are not inherently racist. As a matter of fact, if you go into a Polish bar where they deign to speak English, you will find them no slouches as far as race is concerned. Any group. It isn't just there is this stereotype of the Irish as being, you know, bloody-minded, drunken, brawling racists, and it's simply not true. Yes, there are Irish that get into brawls. Yes, there are Irish that overserve and are overserved. Yes, there are Irish that, in the old days you would find them sprawled out in the alleys from a fight or from having too much to drink. That was true of every other group, too. The Russians have an international reputation.
But they came later.
Yes, they
came. Now they're here.
The Russians are
not coming, they're here.
I know. But the Irish did a lot of constructive things for this country, aside from, see, the Civil War caused the United States population to change its attitudes rather quickly about the Irish. When the Irish came over during the famine, most of them were illiterate, most of them were very, very poor, in rags, and most of them, you know, were living in slums. They were the ghetto people of that period. The 5 points in New York, if you've seen Gangs of New York, if you haven't, I suggest that you see it. I recommend it. It should be shown in every classroom in America. You know, these were the lowlifes, and you didn't want to walk into their neighborhoods after dark.
You know, like Hell's Kitchen.
However, when the Civil War broke out, the armies needed people who had no objection to fighting, and the Irish were pretty good soldiers because they had served in the armies of a number of countries over the centuries. Irish mercenaries served in the French army, served in the German armies, served even in the Ottoman armies. So the Irish had certain skills. Furthermore, there were a lot of educated Irish that everyone overlooked, such as the architect who designed the White House, such as some of the engineers who laid out streets in major cities like New York and Chicago. You know, the Irish drifted into professions like law, like politics, because of the fact that they understood the language and they understood human nature. Some of the greatest clergymen in American history have been Irish Americans.
How do you explain the high incidence of sexual abuse, not only among the priests and bishops, but the nuns, the Magdalens in Ireland especially?
Well, the Magdalens are a case that, you know, even in Ireland there was an effort to discipline that order. Look, in the United States, for most of our history, the predominant ethnic group that made up the clergy were Irish. Why? Because it was a respectable profession. Every Irish family was expected to produce one priest. Boys were encouraged to enter the priesthood. More so than other nationalities where they tended to go into other fields. It wasn't that the Irish had a greater propensity toward bad behavior in that way, but they did have a larger number of Irish who made up the clergy and who made up the hierarchy. Do you blame it on some genetic thing where all of the Irish are perverts, or do you blame it on historical circumstances which led Irish boys to enter the clergy? And, you know, a certain amount of them, had certain failings that no one approved of.
How do you explain there is the perception, and I think there's some credible, that the Irish are, I won't say warped sexually, but sexually repressed. There seems to be more that than if you compare them to the Latinos or the Mediterranean peoples.
Well, I would like to give the names of a few ladies that I know.
Not only ladies, but I mean even the men.
Let them, well, all right, but I can only speak for, well, but anyway, let them answer that question. I will say that, yes, there was a period in Irish history and Irish American history where the church had a very, very puritanical view on anything smacking of sex or the naughty parts. But that comes from a certain period in the 1600s and early 1700s. You've heard about the Jansenist heresy in Holland, which was a reaction to the Puritans. This was the Catholics' answer to Puritanism, and they were going to be even more ultra-puritanical. Most of them came out of seminaries in Holland. Why Holland? Because some other countries weren't very hospitable to that kind of thinking. Now, in during the penal times, when being a Catholic subjected you to all kinds of disabilities, and you were not allowed to train priests in Ireland, all of these guys who wanted to become priests went over to France, or they went to Holland, and they were trained to become priests there. They were indoctrinated in Jansenism without quite realizing it, and they came back over to Ireland and started teaching that. And unfortunately, that was a bacillus which lasted several hundred years, even into the 20th century, where there was a certain amount of Catholic Puritanism that existed. I think you may remember it from when we were in school. It's dying off now because those priests who were trained by the Jansenists and who went through several generations of being trained by priests who learned from that died off. And now you have, you know, really a kind of a healthier view of that. It used to be, as you know, if you went to confession and said, "Father, while I was over in Southeast Asia, I wiped out an entire village just for the heck of it," the priest would give you a penance and that would be it. If, on the other hand, you were to say, when you were a 14-year-old, "I had impure thoughts about so-and-so," you would get a lecture, lasting for 15 minutes. It was because of the fact that a lot of priests were horrified at the idea of sexual sins, but were not so, you know, it's a cultural thing, and it's changed. It's no longer the case today. The church has grown up, people have grown up, and people have things in better perspective than they did in the 1690s and 1700s.
Well, I noticed that a lot of the Catholic universities, USF, Loyola, Creighton, are run by the Jesuits, and it seems that order is dominated, or has been, by Irish ethnics.
Not just by Irish ethnics. You have, remember, the Irish ethnics went into all of the branches of the priesthood. You had a lot of Italians in the Jesuits. You had a lot of Germans who entered both the Jesuits and the Redemptorists. You went into, as you well remember from Maryville, the guys that became priests. You went into those orders that you had contact with. If you knew a priest who was a Redemptorist, chances are you went to a Redemptorist seminary if that was your calling. If you went to a Jesuit school and decided you wanted to become a priest, you probably gave a close look to the Jesuits. And the Jesuits, of course, had the reputation of being basically super priests. I mean, they considered themselves to be, at one point, the Marines of the Church.
Soldier of Christ.
Well, they were, yeah.
St. Ignatius.
Everybody's a soldier of Christ. I mean,
they are more so.
they were God's Marines. And,
some people call them God's SS.
and you know, the Jesuits were among the first missionaries to go to places like Japan and China. And they, unlike many other missionary groups, and I'm going to digress for a moment, when they went to Japan, they noticed that all of the clergy in Japan, the Shinto clergy and the Buddhist clergy, wore saffron orange robes. So they proceeded to wear orange robes.
So they adapted locally.
They adapted locally. A lot of the denominations that did not adapt locally, they didn't gain much foothold.
Mm-hmm.
The genius of Christianity, and the genius of Catholicism in particular, is the ability to adapt to local customs.
How do you...
The Christmas tree, for example, was a German pagan symbol.
Mm-hmm.
We just adopted it.
How do you...
The title Pontifex Maximus,
mm-hmm,
one of the Pope's titles, meaning Great Bridge. That was one of the titles of the Roman emperors. And you'll find in statues, even of Nero, there will be all of these titles. And somewhere in there is Pontifex Maximus.
Since you mentioned the Italians, how do you explain the Jesuit, the head of the Jesuit order is known as the Black Pope?
Well, he's also, his real official title is the General. Because
in more ways than one.
the Jesuits are an order founded by a soldier who was wounded in battle and
mm-hmm.
no longer functioned.
St. Ignatius, right.
Ed became a priest,
mm-hmm.
and he organized his order along military lines. They, for example, every day they read, in addition to their breviary, they read what are known as the spiritual exercises. And these are various readings and pep talks. They live more so than other priests a kind of a disciplined military life. Every few years, however, the general, or Black Pope, if you will, has to go to a meeting with the real Pope, who is also a Jesuit, incidentally, this time around,
mm-hmm.
and has to go to a meeting with the real Pope. And then the Pope is traditionally reminded the head of the Jesuits who runs the church. Now, I wonder how that goes today when you have a Jesuit Pope meeting with the general of the Jesuits.
Of course, there's...
Or does he simply talk to himself? I don't know.
Well, there are people now who are opposing some of the things or misinterpreting some of the proclamations of this current pope.
Well, the current pope hasn't really made any proclamations. What the current pope has done has been to voice certain personal opinions. And no matter what you say or what you do, you are always going to have people disagreeing with you.
Mm-hmm. Right. So at least in our diversity of the races in the Catholic Church, the political fiction doesn't exist that there is just one value.
That there is just one value?
Yeah, no, that's the latest political fiction that we hear, San Francisco's value. A.K.A. everybody thinks alike, and that's not so.
Well, no one in their right mind pretended that everybody.
Except here in California, of course.
Well,
we are unique.
California's a special exception. I mean, I visit there periodically in much the same way that I visit the zoo. You know, a wonderful place to visit. I don't necessarily think I would want to join the.
Okay, that was Patrick Butler, and it's a replay since this is Irish Week. Next week, we're going to discuss the Aruba situation of Vandersloot. Unfortunately, he died, and I didn't get an interview, but we did talk several times. He was Nick Romel was a purser on a cruise ship down in the Caribbean. And we discussed some of the things that go on and how allegedly, and I say allegedly, that young girls and maybe some young males were kidnapped and ended up in the Middle East, especially the women. There seems to be a fixation on blonde, comely young women. But anyway, we'll get into some of that and what may have happened to the southern young lady that disappeared down there in Aruba. So we're going to end with our usual, politics and poker, which is quite familiar to the Irish, with people like Boss Tweed, Richard Daley the First, and the Kennedys, and so we're with our usual politics and poker. We will be back Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, and we will have more up on our YouTube page, Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Hey, Tony,
what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Me too. Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year. Big Ace.
Ace Bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the plan?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's about we should make Jack Riley the guy?
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, better.
Politics or poker, which is more important?
Paraphrase.
Bet 'em.
Little phrase, good as gold.
I'll say. Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fajicinkovic, I'm certain it's run.
Mike is out, I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen, and George is in jail.
We could run out Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot, that's me!
Politics and poker, politics and poker. Play for a pot, that's mediocre. Politics and poker, rubbing neck and neck. If politics seems more predictable, that's because usually you can stack the
Paul Vizola. Have a safe weekend. We'll be back Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Good night.